talk about hobby horses, Terriet, and this judicial industry, you know, and part of me actually hopes this province goes broke. Well, because, you know, I think we would solve a lot of our problems.
You strangle off a lot of these problems if you strangle off the funding for the civil service. Before we talk to Chris Delaney, we've got a bit of progress that I'd like to report on issues that we try to bring to the fore here. And, Carrie, you've been so good on issues regarding health and regulation of health issues and things like that. And I know that off and on over the last year, I think at least a half a dozen times, we have talked about a piece of federal legislation. It was called Bill 6, and it's now called Bill 36. It's the Canadian Consumer Product Safety Act.
Sounds so nice.
Sounds so benign, so nice.
I'm being taken care of again.
So nice, everything like exactly, you know, the government can look after you. You know, we're all consumers of products, and we all want those to be safe. But, you know, we have, and with your leadership, Carrie, we have had many, many guests on the show from Natural Health Federation of Canada. We've had a senator on the show talking about issues regarding the unbelievable powers that this act gives to civil servants, health inspectors, the power to search and destroy, essentially, shut down businesses, take as samples anything that they want, seize inventory, all without warrants. I mean, if you were a murderer
and you have to help them,
a machine gun there, they have to go to the court to get a warrant. But, you know, something like this, where it's your livelihood, your business, they don't have to. Anyway, we've pounded on this issue.
We have. We've been down this road a lot.
We've been down there. We've been down the Roadkill Radio Road on this one for a long time. And then, lo and behold, the lead editorial in yesterday's National Post. There it is right there, folks, with my notes on it. A bureaucrat's dream come true. It says the entire editorial is devoted to Canadian Consumer Product Safety Act, and it advances a line of opposition that is virtually identical to the line that we've been advancing
here. Well, I think that's actually
for
my
the last
title.
Year. So, you know, I've often said the National Post is not part of the downstream media. We've given them a paddle, and they're in the mainstream. The Post has said, it's admitted that the act has received very little headlines, and guys at the editorial board, go and talk to your news editor and ask them why that is. And then they go through all the points that we've been raising. I mean, here's the law requires, the new law removes the requirement for Health Canada inspectors to obtain a warrant to search and seize private property to place a business. Section 21 provides that inspectors may at any reasonable time enter a place, including a car, where they have reasonable grounds to believe a consumer product is manufactured, et cetera, and once there, the inspectors can examine or test anything, take samples free of charge, open packages, examine documents, seize products, and the vehicles used to transport them, order the owner of the vehicle, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well,
it goes
on,
and we've been saying that, folks, and thank you, National Post, for
finally listening to
Roadkill
Radio.
Well, you know, they're listening to other voices, I hope, too. And, Terry, congratulations on this. Well, I mean, we don't need validation from the National Post, but it's certainly good when they pay attention
to
this
stuff. But you know what, Terry, I think that's also, and our listeners and viewers know this, there's so much being missed in the media as far as, or the downstream media as we refer to it, because it's such a herd mentality, and once that herd gets going, they don't look to the right or to the left, they don't listen to the people, because you know what, it's our audience that sends us this insight,
I want to crack a whip on the butt end of that herd and get them to go in the right direction instead of the wrong direction. Start stampeding to get this bill killed, or at least severely amended.
Do you want me to get you a whip?
For Christmas?
I might have a few.
Diamonds.
That's because I have horses, people.
Okay, that's right. Hey, listen. Now we're gonna go into some serious issue in a minute with Chris Delaney talking about provincial politics. And before we go there, there's an even more serious thing. One of my heroes and one of the people who've inspired me over the last 20 years in journalism and in the sort of active journalism and standing up for what you believe in, and that's certainly what we do here It's inspired me as well to take a run at municipal politics last year. It's inspired me to continue writing for the National Post and the Tri-City News to keep involved in the public process, to stand up for what's right. As a woman named Heather Stillwell, who has served on the school board for many, many years. I run for higher office as well, the Surgeon Surrey, run for higher office. A great woman, an inspiring woman, a strong advocate for the family, strong on life issues, is now herself suffering from pretty severe cancer and is not doing well. Heather, I don't think you're listening tonight, but I hope that the word gets to her that she's in our thoughts and prayers here on Roadkill Radio. Yeah. We love her.
And admire her.
We love her and admire her.
She has worked tirelessly on behalf of people that just had no voice.
That's right. And know, Heather, that you've got friends here on Roadkill Radio, and I think many of our listeners probably know of you and support you as well. And I hope the word gets passed along to her and that that this brings her some peace. She's a beautiful woman,
yes.
And our thoughts and prayers with her and her family as she struggles with a debilitating illness. I think that's all we can say at this stage. So it's not a nice thing to introduce into the middle of the show, but I think it's an important one that I needed to do while we can say it.
Well, she has a lot of friends in our Roadkill Radio audience, Terry, and I know that they'd want to know.
Yeah. Anyway, let's pause for a few seconds here, and we're gonna bring in Chris Delaney, and
we're getting the nods. From
we're
the
getting the nods
room.
Here. Okay, so.
Well, you know what? I want to just bring everybody up to speed on another little bit of information. A week and a bit ago, we put out a press release in conjunction with a letter that I put off to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Lawrence Cannon, about the United Nations report. And Canada gave our unwavering support to bring in mandatory sex education to all the schools. Of course, nobody heard about that, and we certainly didn't read about that in the downstream media.
Another manifestation of gentrification.
Yeah, right. Well, exactly, because, you know, the patriarchal system, Terry, you know, it's the end-all, be-all of all evils,
That's right.
Anyway, just an update on that. I haven't had a letter back yet from him. I know, and he hasn't agreed to the interview as of yet.
Right. Well, that's a pity. That's right. Well,
I know. Okay. Are you shocked?
Absolutely. I'm full of moral outrage because Canadians are great at moral outrage. So I'm going to be full of moral outrage on this issue here. Let's just join. I want to be part of the majority of Canadians. I'm going to have my Canadian hat with me tonight.
Put it on for this one.
That's right. Here.
There you go.
Like a good Canadian, I'm morally outraged that Lawrence Cannon is not coming on our show to answer these important questions about why Canada, the United Nations, is supporting this noxious little movement.
And quite honestly, you know what the best thing he could do is just write back to us and say, we screwed up. You know, I wasn't watching. Thanks for the heads up, guys at Roadkill.
And speaking of screwing up, the BC Liberal government. Now, if you're listening in from Ontario, you can just
you'd have to make that plural. Screw ups
there, the McGuinty government. Pretty screwy uppy there as well. That's a good expression.
Screwy uppy.
Anyway, we've got a BC Liberal screwy uppy. I'll write that
what'd
down
you do
next
today?
To gentrification.
I only had one screwy uppy.
One screwy uppy after another. Well, that's the BC Liberal government. Now they're all falling out of the limbs to run for the BC Liberal leadership. It's a confusing time in BC Liberal politics.
Are you confused,
Well,
Terry?
You know what? It's an unsettled time. It's that old Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. It's not chaos. But I think Chris Delaney would like to see a little chaos out there. Chris, are you there to talk to us about the sort of chaos that you want to bring to the political system in British Columbia?
Well, I was going to say, Terry, and by the way, hello, Carrie and Terry.
Hi, Chris.
But I was going to say, I don't know if you could describe what's going on there as a little bit of chaos. It's more of a meltdown, if you ask me. But
what's the difference? What's the difference between chaos and a meltdown? Come on now.
Well, chaos means it's unorchestrated and that things are happening that are sort of out of control. What I see actually is a very orchestrated attempt by the government to continue to stonewall against the people on the HST, and the result has been that their position with the public is melting down and they're losing their moral authority to govern. We've seen three candidates come forward so far and say they want to take over the leadership from the former premier who ostensibly, lost his premiership over this issue, and they're all saying the same things as he said. So it almost it's like watching a puppet show where the script has been written before they ever open their mouths.
Well, I don't think they're doing it to win friends. Listening to Kevin Falcon today, I think he firmly believes that the HST has got economic benefits. It's the right thing for British Columbia. I mean, it'd be pretty easy for him to go against it, would it not?
Well, I think it doesn't matter what he believes, and I think that's the problem, is they all believe it, but the public that they serve doesn't believe it, so what difference does it make what they believe? And that's the problem, is they can't seem to overcome their own, I don't know if you want to call it narcissism or what their problem is, but this whole idea that they know what's best for British Columbia versus the people who elected them, and that's the disconnect. So if they continue with it, we may not even get to a referendum in June, which is what they're talking about, because by that point we'll have had seven or eight recalls will have been undertaken, and if even a few of them is successful, I'm not sure that we'll even get to a referendum.
Well, there was my reference earlier on to the what you want to unleash on the province of British Columbia, because that's certainly not in the scenario that any of the BC Liberal candidates is laying out. You know, they're all talking about, if I'm leader, we'll move up the date of the referendum. They're not really addressing that freight train that's coming rolling down the tracks right at them, and that's the recall campaigns. And that's what I like. Well, let's talk about what exactly is going on. It's been in the headlines over the wording of the recall against Ida Chong and Victoria Airy was rejected, but now it's been resubmitted. So tell us what's happening there, and then tell us what's happening generally with the recall campaigns, too.
Right. Well, specifically what happened, of course, was last Monday, not the one that just passed, but the week before, the recall proponents for Oak Bay Gordon Head filed the application with the chief electoral officer, and 3 days later on Wednesday afternoon found out that the chief electoral officer had drafted new rules concerning the use of acronyms in the statement that is attached to the recall petition, which said that the word MLA and HST were actually not single acronym words. They were instead multiple words, MLA being member of the Legislative Assembly and HST being harmonized sales tax.
Yeah, and by the way, to that secret ruling, I would like to add my little acronym, and that is WTF. And if you do any texting, you'll know what that means. But anyway, let's move on, Chris.
Yeah. Well, what made it very strange about the ruling was that he didn't say that it had to be written in full. He didn't say that it had to be written in full just the one time. He said that you had to do it every time you referenced it. So that added 67 words to a 180-word original submission out of an allowable 200 words. So we were over by, I don't know, 47 words or something.
Right.
It was ridiculous. So even the word 2010, the date, which is normally considered a word, he said is now had to be written as 2010.
Oh, so four words.
It was very strange. Yeah.
And, WTF.
It made no sense. It didn't even make sense from a legal standpoint. You know, in law, they don't say that. And in law, you sometimes reference HST or MLA the first time in full, and then afterwards the acronym is
fine.
Well,
I was going to say,
according to the
In law, they want everything as short and concise as possible.
Well, you know, like the old Canadian Press style guide that I was bred on when I first started in the business, your first reference, you would always spell out the entire name and in brackets put the acronym beside it or the initials. And then from there on, you use that little acronym to save space. And is it, I mean, it's sort of a philosophical question, is that acronym actually a word or not? I mean, people look at it and I think, in your mind, you treat it as, it's a very interesting little question, but my goodness.
Well, the Oxford English Dictionary says that an acronym is a word.
Oh, good.
And in the case of MLA and HST, more people actually understand what an MLA is than would understand what you meant if you said member of the legislative assembly.
Well,
some of them might not get it. But.
Well, that was what I was going to say, because, you know, if this is all about clarity and making sure the wording is accurate, like we're doing on the referendum question, right? I agree with you, Chris. More people would be more familiar with the term MLA and liken that to their member of parliament or legislative assembly or whatever, right? To put out the whole word like that.
So
what's with it?
Okay. So is your contention that the man who made this ruling, sort of after the fact, these new rules that were done in secret, is he actively biased against your campaign to recall this particular MLA, and then from there on other MLAs, or is this just a matter of he's a dunderhead or what? What is your contention?
Well, we don't know what his motivation is, but we do recognize a pattern that has emerged since he took over as the acting CEO. So the first thing he did was he ruled against us when we asked him to investigate the BC Liberal website for the HST, which had advocacy videos on it during the petition, which on our own video, our own website, any of that stuff had to be accounted for as initiative expenses, whereas he exempted the Liberals from that, and yet a couple weeks before he had taken on the position, the same agency, Elections BC, had said that the mail-out that was planned by the Liberals wasn't allowed because it would be initiative advertising. So he made an exception there, and we kind of scratched our heads, but we didn't say much because at that point we basically won it and we'd already succeeded. But then his next thing, which was really huge, was when he actually broke the law and refused to submit the successful petition to the Standing Committee of the Legislature, and we had to go to the Supreme Court of British Columbia to get the Chief Justice to order him to submit it. So that was very strange and actually quite unusual for that to happen. Again, no pattern yet, but some strange decision-making. And then the next big one was when all of a sudden he sent out all of these letters. I guess it turned out of 710,000 signatures, 2,000 were duplicates, which is actually infinitesimal when you consider that number of signatures. But nevertheless, he sent out letters to mostly elderly citizens who had accidentally signed it twice, threatening 2 years in jail and $10,000 fines. Like without even telling us who had done it. So, and then this latest thing, well, actually preceding this, he made the statement that he couldn't conduct a referendum on the HST any sooner than.
Oh, we just lost.
We lost you.
Far away.
Okay.
And so he's been. There's a pattern there of obstruction that is disconcerting, especially coming from an acting CEO who's supposed to be just a placeholder until they get the main person, and who was appointed by the premier instead of by the legislature, as is normally the case.
What is this person's background?
Well, he's originally a clerk of the legislature, I guess, for the last 12 years, which means he deals directly with the government and takes orders from the government and does what they want. So he's fairly close to the government in the sense that that's his role, although generally speaking, most people respected him as a fairly impartial, civil servant doing his job. But I think two things have emerged. I'm not sure that he's colluding with the government, but I think he has a hostility toward democracy. I think he's one of these people who shares the elite view that democracy is a necessary evil. So I think he's sort of intolerant of it and doesn't really like the process. And secondly, he's used to doing what the government wants and trying to be pleasing to the government. So maybe he hasn't quite lost that mindset. But the chief electoral officer's role is one of the guardian of democracy and the guardian of the voting process. It has to be somebody who believes in democracy strongly and wants to be an advocate for it. And he's clearly the other way.
So now that, your issue has essentially been cleared up now that you were able to resubmit. Did you have to go and get new paperwork on all the for all the campaigners as well? I was reading about that last week.
Right. So, the approval of the petition today was good news. It means on Monday. But what a lot of people don't press release is that none of the canvasser applications have been approved yet. So there's not much canvassing you can do on Monday if you don't have any canvassers. So there's about 250 applications that were handed in to them today, and we're hopeful or cautiously optimistic that they'll have those approved by the end of the week, unless he decides to create new rules yet again, which he did you know, on the petition application. So hopefully that won't happen. And I think the public outcry against him was so great that he'd be a little hesitant to try that one again.
Well, as far as making up the rules, does he have the authority to do this just on the fly? Is there no order in council that's necessary or anything like that?
Well, apparently he does have the authority. The chief electoral officer is quite autonomous in his role, and he has enormous authority. Actually, it raises a whole other debate, as far as I'm concerned, for the next government, which is that this position actually needs some accountability built into it. It's far too powerful. So the short answer is, yeah, he has the authority, the legislative authority, but he doesn't have the moral authority. What he did was unethical in the extreme, mm-hmm. and it was completely inappropriate. It's contrary to all of our democratic traditions in this country, which is to have a fair and level playing field. Canadians are very fairness-oriented. We know what the rules are, and we play by them. So when somebody does something like this, it's a very, very affront to the people and very upsetting to them. And so it was very uncharacteristic of anybody in a senior role like that, and showed an extremely poor lack of judgment on his part at the minimum, and worse, you know, some sort of desire to actually try to scuttle the petition, at least temporarily, maybe in the hopes of, you know, slowing the momentum or something. I don't know, but just a terrible decision.
Yeah. So what does the timeline look like now for Oak Bay Gordon Head for the first recall and then the campaign?
Yeah, so it's a 60-day campaign, and it'll start on December the 6th, so it will finish on February the 4th. That's the full 60 days. In that particular case, because they're going through the Christmas break, there'll be a bit of a break between Christmas and New Year's where the campaign will stop, and then they'll pick it up again. And that was one of the reasons why they wanted to start last week, and now they've lost a week, was because they wanted to get the momentum going and pretty well get it done before Christmas, and then use the New Year just to kind of clean up any remaining signatures that they hadn't got. But now they'll just have to work a little bit harder, but I think if everything goes per the plan this week, then starting on the 6th won't be the end of the world. But it really does put us back by about almost 2 weeks from where we wanted to start.
Okay, again, for I know you've gone over this before with on the show, but I'd like the new listeners to be familiar with what your bigger plans are in terms of how you're going to roll out ever more recall campaigns. Bring down the government in a way, or at least force the government.
Our objective from the beginning has always been to get rid of the HST, necessarily to get rid of the person who gave it to us. So when Premier Campbell resigned, you know, a lot of people seem to think we should be satisfied with that, but we said, no, our goal is to get rid of the HST. We don't care who the leader of the Liberal Party is, and so what we've said is in phase three here, which we're in now, which is recall, is that we would be responsible about it. We would act responsibly so as not to threaten the government, but only to put pressure on to get rid of the HST. So we're beginning with one recall, and then we will add another two recalls every month thereafter. So that gives the government plenty of time to assess whether the recalls themselves are a serious threat, if there's support for them, and then to take a look and say, okay, you know what? We didn't get it when you handed us the petition. We didn't get it when all the polls told us. We haven't listened to you yet, but it looks like these MLAs are being recalled now, which would also be a unique thing because there's never been a successful recall yet other than Paul Reitzma, but he resigned before the count could be done. So, you know, hopefully that would bring them to their senses and they would say, okay, we're going to get rid of the HST or we're going to move the referendum up into January or February, which is the other option we've given them. We said, if you really want to go the referendum route, that's fair, but do it in a timely manner so that we don't damage the economy while everybody's waiting to find out that nobody wants the tax. But they're playing games with it. Kevin Falcon today announced the same games again. He wants to move it up into June, which is interesting because the chief electoral officer had said about 3-4 weeks ago that it would take 1 year minimum to do a referendum. He couldn't do it any sooner. Well, now suddenly he's talked to him and he can cut the time by 3 or 4 months. So, you know, it keeps changing every time you talk. So I figure if we recall a couple of people, they'll find out they can actually do a referendum in 1 or 2 months, and we'll find out that could happen.
Rules are fluid, Chris Delaney.
That's right. Now, Christmas is going to be, I mean, people's attention are focused elsewhere. They've been hearing about the HST a long time. Are you still seeing the same sort of level of support that was there last spring and through the summer and even into the early part of this fall? Or is people's generally the support and the interest is beginning to lag now? for your
campaigns? Well, no, I do think the emotions ebb and flow, which is a good thing. You can't have people sitting there angry, clenching their teeth for a year straight. But
it works here for 2 hours at a time.
Hey. Yeah, once a week.
you guys are good at it. But the this recent decision by the chief electoral officer for a lot of people was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
So what happened was we got another 40 or 50 volunteers that came out of the woodwork after that happened because they were so mad. They said, and these were people actually who were liberals before who said, you know, I kind of was willing to accept the HST, but this has gone too far. So I think a lot of people are looking at it as an opportunity to send the government a message. And because it's the only recall that's ongoing, it is an opportunity to send a very clear message to the government without actually threatening the government. So I think you're going to see a surprise there. I think the people are very motivated in that riding to do this. And one of the reasons they wanted to do it before Christmas is because it's a very affluent riding. It's a very highly educated riding. There's a number of retirees there who actually leave the riding in the new year right after Christmas and go down south, the snowbirds as they call them. And they'd come forward and said, you know, we really want to sign this. Would you please initiate the recall before Christmas? And so that's why they decided to do it there, because probably a good 10 to 15% of that riding vacates the riding in the new year.
Now, speaking of people leaving the Liberal Party or ex-Liberals who are supporting you now, and one of the things that has been interesting to me about the political dynamic here is that we've seen the exodus, and we've seen you with your party and Wilf Hannay with his party, and we've also got the BC Conservative Party making noises, and Lord knows there's a lot of other ones out there as well. The BC Liberals must be getting pretty thin in the ranks. Is there a possibility now, or is it practical, to actually sort of at this stage turn around and start thinking maybe it's time to mount some sort of campaign to take over the BC Liberals and to get it back on the track that we want it to get onto, more populist or more representative or more democratic?
Right.
And any thoughts in that sense, Crystallini?
Well, it's a good point, Terry. People have mentioned that to me. They've even suggested that I should go and run for leader of the
Well, thing. That was my next question, Chris.
Yeah. The difficulty with that situation is that the party itself is controlled by the establishment, both here in British Columbia, but also in Eastern Canada. So, and that's one of the reasons they're in the trouble that they're in, is because if they were flexible on issues like the HST, and if they were committed to issues like BC Hydro and public ownership of resources and management of those resources to the benefit, you know, British Columbians first instead of big corporations, then they wouldn't be in this mess. But they're not. And so trying to turn that tide around, I think, is next to impossible. You're better off to try from outside. And I think Diane Watts sort of made that point better than anybody by simply saying she didn't want the job. Normally, a governing party that's strong, that's well-financed and funded, and they're begging you to come and run, that's your opportunity to really advance. And I think Diane is a terrific person and probably would have done very, very well for them. But even she saw that the changes that would be required there were not going to be possible. So what's the point of hitching your cart to that horse only to find out that you're going to squander all of the goodwill and sort of integrity that you've built as mayor of Surrey? So that sort of hit at home. If she won't take the job, why would anybody else?
Right. And is your sense that Christy Clark, a federal Liberal and provincial BC Liberal and hotline host, a rival here at Roadkill Radio?
No rival. No contest.
It's part of the downstream media. Is it your sense that she'll likely...
Hey, we don't call Canadians bad Canadians because they don't get shot up full of the swine flu vaccination. Canadians. Yeah.
So your sense that she'll run for the leadership, or what's your prediction there?
Yeah, no question. She's going to run. She's going to come out. I think the party has basically tapped her on the shoulder and Kevin Falcon and said, you guys fight it out. We're fine with either one of you. You're both solidly behind the HST. You're both solidly behind Premier Campbell's agenda. You know what? We're fine with either one of you. You guys go fight it out. We'll make it look like there's a contest. It's really the Punch and Judy show. The same guy is operating, you know, both puppets, and that's all they are. They're not fooling anybody, and, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, it'd be a no-brainer if you wanted to not only win the leadership but also win the province's satisfaction or confidence back. All you'd have to do is say, if I'm elected leader, I'm canceling the HST. Mm-hmm. And the cheer that would go up in British Columbia would be audible, and yet neither one of them is going to do it because they can't do it. Right. So all it is the same agenda, the same status quo with a different face. And the Liberals in their marketing department think that that's what will work with British Columbians, but we're not that stupid.
Now, with your involvement in the recall campaign and the Fight HST, and you're also your political involvement, what sort of overlap is there going to be? Obviously, you're making a lot of new friends, a lot of active people. How do you keep these? I mean, you're a very scrupulous person. Are you having to keep things separate so you don't have the political, well, your partisan politics coming into the HST and the recall? Or do you think that it's fair game, it's all part of the same thing, and you're going to tap that guy on the shoulder to do this for your party after you finish with them on HST and recall?
Well, yeah, I think it's a totally fair question, Terry. I actually think there's a lot of overlap between Fight HST and the BC First Party, and that's a result of the fact that the BC First Party kind of grew out of the Fight HST. So unlike the Conservatives or Will Fanny's new party or BC Refed or these other parties that are in existence, which to a certain degree are trying to capitalize on the anti-HST sentiment that's out there, and that's part of politics, that's their right. BC First is an actual direct outgrowth of that movement against the HST, because people said to us, okay, Bill, Chris, terrific, we get rid of one of these Liberals in a recall and we don't want NDP, who do we vote for? And we'd list the alternatives, and they were like, no, you know, been there, done that, we didn't want that. So there was a sort of a demand for this new party, and I was originally trying to steer people toward the Conservatives because I was a member, and when I found out that the federal Conservatives got in there and sort of took it over and pushed it toward being a pro-HST party, I actually had no choice but to leave. So at that point, it made it simple to go in and be a part of BC First. So there's a huge amount of overlap, and I don't know that there's any way to avoid that.
Now, you mentioned Bill.
Separate entities, obviously, and there's a number of people in Fight HST that are not BC First. Obviously, there's many who are from other parties, and they're welcome because it's a multi-partisan coalition.
Now, you mentioned Bill, as in Bill Vanderzam, who's been very high profile to Fight HST and on the recall. And now, pardon my ignorance on this, but what's his involvement exactly with BC First?
Well, Bill has no involvement with any political party right now. He hasn't been a member of a political party probably since the BC Unity days, probably about 8 or 10 years now. But and he's made the decision. You know, I asked him if he would come and join us and help us, and he said he feels that his role is best as a nonpartisan person, because as the leader of the movement, he has to be seen to be, you know, not advancing any particular cause. But he's also said that when this thing is finished, he's going to support whatever political party is out there that is advocates system change and the restoration of our democracy, and also the end of the HST. So, you know, BC First, I think, would be very favorable to Bill, but that's a decision for him, and I think he'll make that once the fight at the HST is over.
Well, what are some of the party platforms that would provide that direction for a political party, Chris?
Right. Well, one of the things is, because we're, you know, essentially coming out of a pro-democracy movement, it's very important for the members and the citizens of British Columbia to determine those policies. But at the same time, you can't expect them to sort of just throw things out there. You've got to provide some leadership. So what we've been doing is we've been developing a number of policy proposals together with members of our board and other members of the party, and actually members of the public at large that are just supportive of the idea, and trying to develop a consensus around those policies that are largely populist, BC First-based types of policies. So we've listed out four major policy planks that are now on our website, and we'll do another probably four or six, so we'll hit about 10 major policy areas. And the idea there is to just get enough to show people the direction of the party so that they come and support it, but not so much that you've covered off every single thing and there's nothing left for the members to do. We want the members to come and help build the party and suggest the types of policies they want. So we're going to get about, like I say, 10 or 11 key planks that we can put forward that people can look at and feel comfortable with and say, yeah, that's the kind of party I want to support. So we've done energy, we've done environment, we've done taxation, and and one other, I'm sorry. Oh, and democratic reform.
Right.
So, and anybody wants to see them can go to our website at bcfirst.com.
And, dot, dot ca, isn't it? Is it .com or .ca?
Well, it was .ca, and we got the domain name for .com, so actually either one will get you to the site, .ca or .com, okay. but that's very astute of you, Terry.
I was just on the .ca, and I'll just check.
It was originally .ca,
so you're on the ball. Okay, it's the same thing here. Okay, .ca, .com. Well, good. Well, you got the both of them covered. That's always important. And you've had some fairly high-profile people join your team lately. Can you run down some of the people that you've been bragging about?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we've had a number of really good people come forward, business people and teachers, educators, different people. So Douglas Day, who used to be a federal conservative, actually during the Mulroney years, an organizer for them, also a very prominent business person, home builder in the Squamish area, he's come forward. Educator in Penticton, fellow by the name of Ron Barilaro, has agreed to come onto the board. The mayor of Invermere, Jerry Taft, has also agreed to come on our board. Sue Blair, who used to work in the mayor's office in Calgary under Ralph Klein and has been in the business logging industry and business management and consulting many years, has joined. Reiner Schmall is our webmaster. He's a superb web guy. Blake McKenzie, Sal Vetro. Sal was the founder of the party, of course.
Right.
Ron Zalko has also come onto the board. So famous Ron Zalko from the fitness world club. And a number of others coming forward, and we're working on getting a couple more, maybe a lawyer and a couple others to advise us on legal issues, that kind of thing. So
now,
it's a good board because it's a pro tem board. They'll have to we'll elect a board in the founding convention, but this will get us there.
Now, your principles you list on your website, I think about a dozen principles or ten principles. The very first one is always an interesting one, and that's a BC first approach. That will protect, so BC First Party stands for a BC First approach that will protect and promote the interests of British Columbia and its citizens as the first priority. What are these sort of areas? You could use this to sort of tackle just about any area. You know, everything from international whaling conventions to global warming conferences in Cancun to interprovincial trade to Canada's involvement in Afghanistan. Does BC First see itself saying, okay, big issue, what role should the country have in Afghanistan? Well, no, we're not going to look at it from that point of view. We're going to look at it, is it good for BC or not? Are you going to go that far? I mean, how far does this BC First philosophy and stance actually extend? And I'm also thinking, will it become parochial that way? Or are you going to kind of look out for the welfare of your of downtrodden people? I don't know. You know, like how far does this go?
Right.
This...
I think what it means is that, and we're not talking about changing the power structure of the province relative to Ottawa or anywhere else in the world, but of course, Confederation gave the provinces a fairly powerful sovereign ability to manage their own affairs. And what's happened over time is that via taxation and legislation and other things, the province has given away some of its sovereignty to Ottawa. And we've also seen a number of decisions made, particularly by this government, that has given away some of our economic sovereignty in the sale of BC Rail and the dismantling of BC Hydro to foreign corporations. So what BC First means is that we'll use the powers within Confederation, within the structure that we have, to assert provincial rights and to look after the economic well-being and political interests of the province first and foremost. That's a kind of a no-brainer in the sense that that's the role of the provincial government. But unfortunately, that role has been diminished somewhat, I think deliberately, over time. Now, we live in a global world. There's no question that you have to engage with foreign corporations and foreign governments and a number of things for trade and that, and nothing wrong with that. But the first and foremost responsibility of the BC government is to ensure that whatever it does inures to the benefit of the people of British Columbia, not to some foreign corporation. And BC Hydro is probably the best example. We've got this run-of-river situation now where we're creating private power via foreign companies like General Electric with a guaranteed per megawatt electricity rate, which is actually higher than what the market will bear. So it's actually gutting the treasury of BC Hydro while they pay private producers a rate that's higher than what they can get on the marketplace. There's so decisions like that, yeah, would have to be reversed.
Right. There's been some reporting done on the problem that's very similar in Ontario that's developing and is going to explode in a very big way on the energy costs. The McGuinty government has committed itself to all sorts of high-cost energy in the name of fighting global warming and lowering the carbon footprint, as they say. And it's absolutely unaffordable. I think it's worse in Ontario than it is in BC, from what I gather,
yeah,
but I haven't seen it.
It's not only unaffordable, it's also completely misguided, because anthropogenic global warming has basically been refuted. I mean, it's been proven to be essentially a hoax. The information coming out of East Anglia University, which provides the data to the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, was exposed to be fraudulent. So we
not all
know
of it,
that
yes.
the science supporting that is even, you know, valid. So here you have governments creating wholesale policies to do with energy that are extremely costly and extremely damaging to their own economies, based on a science that doesn't even have any certainty surrounding it. This is part of the pressure of globalism, for global corporations and global governments to try to influence the agendas of sovereign national states like the provinces here in Canada and like Canada itself. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a pushback. I think people see that and they're saying, hey, hold on a second here. This isn't in our interest.
Good. And the on that, the issue of, we started the show actually almost 2 hours ago now. I was asking Carrie why she wasn't in Cancun, because we have the big global accountability, the big follow-up to Copenhagen taking place in Cancun now. And I noted that it was very interesting. I think that there is some self-correcting in Canada going on, because we had the Climate Accountability Act killed by the Senate just a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, there wasn't that sort of storm of moral outrage on the front pages of the paper, and the population didn't rise up.
The universities didn't shut down.
Yeah, they kind of said, you know what, the Senate has a right to do that, and good for the Senate. And you know,
well,
people,
that's because nobody knew about it.
People,
it was on the
well, maybe,
it was buried.
Why,
right?
Was it buried? Because I think the newspapers are coming to their senses a bit here as well, thinking, you know, global warming is not the big issue.
When you walk out, yeah.
And it's also...
When you walk out your door and...
Yeah, no, it's not the big issue. You know, the climate gate was certainly big. The fact there haven't been so many of the doom and gloom things that Al Gore talked about and the Inconvenient Truth have not come true. And you've also got
a
clear and present danger of the environment, of the economy. I mean, people all of a sudden are realizing, you know, what are our priorities, you know, here? Governments are too big. The debt is too high. Can we really afford to play around with the stuff that's so uncertain to begin with and spend billions of dollars? And I think, you know, it's a big campaign that I've been on for almost 20 years. I've been talking about global warming alarmism and chicken littleism. I can remember early in the 90s.
Those are some isms I've never heard
chicken littleism
before.
Chicken littleism.
Yeah.
And finally, people are, you know... obviously, it's coming back now. So I'm kind of pleased with that, and I'm glad to see you're talking about that too, because I saw on one of your principles, Chris, the ninth principle, sustainable use of resources and protection of the environment for use by future generations, which can mean anything, right?
Well, it can, but it also, I think, is very specific in the sense that it's saying for use. And the key is use. A lot of protectionism and environmental protectionism is based upon the non-use of the environment by humans. And so our environment policy is what I call a people-friendly one. It's designed to use the environment for people and to conserve it. So there's a big difference between conservation and preservation. And we don't believe in preservation for the sake of preservation. We believe in conservation, which means wise use of the resource so that you have it in the future.
Well, in fact, you put out a press release called BC First Unveils New People-Friendly Environment Policy, making that distinction.
We did that. We did that deliberately because we wanted to distinguish ourselves from, say, the Green Party, which seems to be, you know, put Mother Earth as the number one priority of everything. We see it a little bit in reverse. The Earth, of course, is what we sustain ourselves on, so you can't use it unwisely and you can't abuse it. But at the same time, the purpose of environmental policy has to be to the greater benefit of mankind, of human beings, so that we can all live a better life. And we do that by working, you know, holistically in conjunction with the Earth, but not preserving the Earth just for the sake of it. But this whole global warming thing I was trying to say earlier is it's coming undone simply because the empirical evidence is contrary to what they've been saying. I mean, it was mid-November here, and we walked out our doors in Vancouver. It was minus 10 degrees. I mean, that's unheard of. I've been living here now in the Lower Mainland for 25, 26 years, and I don't ever remember it being as cold as the last three winters. So if there's a trend of warming, would somebody please tell me? Because in England, it's snowing in London now for the first time in 100 years. So
I keep saying, bring it on, quick, you know, especially when all my ground and water was frozen last week.
So, Chris,
Global warming would actually be nice.
Yeah.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us tonight. I know you're a very busy man, and it's busy time now for all the campaigns that you're involved with, and I do want to thank you for joining us tonight and giving us so much of your insight and expertise into the matters at hand. And it's, again, going to be a very interesting Christmas period and Oak Bay Garden ahead, and then into the new year as all the events, the provincial political events, Liberal leadership, new premier in place at the end of February. Meantime, he or she might have a caucus. It's one person short or something. So we'll
see how it goes. We'll catch up with you in January or February. If it looks like the recall succeeds, we'll have lots to talk about then. Yeah. But you guys have a great show, and it's very much appreciated. I very much appreciate being invited on because it's an opportunity to discuss in depth some of these complex issues. So appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Chris.
Our pleasure, Chris. Good night.
You know, and
thanks, guys.
Thank you. Good night. And well, speaking as a segue here, we're talking about snow. It's getting to be that time of the year again. And
I have a rule. We don't mention the word till December 1st.
Okay,
go ahead.
We have to because, and here's the school board in Chilliwack. School trustees in Chilliwack, the lovely little city in the Upper Fraser Valley.
The Bible Belt.
Of Chilliwack. Did something most shocking.
Were you shocked?
Recently. Shocking.
I was
absolutely
shocked.
Absolutely shocking. They voted unanimously to put Christmas back on the education map in their school district. They said that from now on, the term winter vacation will no longer appear in any school materials. You know what it's going to be called? Christmas holidays. They are going to call Christmas
holidays.
Not winter
vacation.
What a
concept.
Not, you know, not some sort of mid-season break. Not some sort of multicultural festival of diversity.
Don't give them ideas, Terry.
It's going to be Christmas holidays. And the Vancouver Province newspaper editorialized about this just yesterday and said that after they reported on this, their readers wrote in emails and letters and phone calls were overwhelmingly in favor of keeping Christmas in Christmas. And this reminded me of something that, and you know, we could have a whole show on this
issue. That was what I'm thinking.
A whole show on this, but just a couple of weeks ago, the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, urged Germans who were debating Muslim immigration, it's a big thing in Europe.
Big issue.
To stand up more for Christian values. And she said that multiculturalism, or multicult as they call it, had not worked in her country.
Actually, multi-cult is a really good descriptor for what's gone on. It is a cult.
Right. And now, keeping the name Christmas holidays is not exactly the same as standing up for Christian values, but I think we're seeing something here. I think when we're talking about it, not just Upper Fraser Valley school trustees and little corner of British Columbia and little corner of Canada and little corner of North America passing a resolution, we're not just talking about them saying, darn it, it's Christmas holidays and we're going to call it that and we're proud of it and we're not going to be politically correct. We're not just talking about them, but we're talking about the chancellor of one of the most powerful, important, economic, political, military powers in the world, Germany, saying we have to stand up for Christian values and not be afraid to assert them. I think something is going on here, folks, and I think it's something that's really, really important. So, Carrie and everyone who's out there, as we get ready for the upcoming Christmas season and Christmas holidays, and I'm sorry, but we have to mention it today, Carrie, even though it's not December.
Okay, always got to be someone that breaks the rules.
But you know what? It's not really, because Advent has begun. Last Sunday was the first Sunday of Advent, and we started singing in our church our Christmas Advent songs of longing.
Well, then it's official.
Yeah, it is official. So we have begun the Advent season. So we can talk about these things, and I think we can celebrate the fact that that this is an important time, an important part of our culture and our heritage, and that if we
and
do
our traditions,
if we stand up for Christian values, we also stand up for our Christian celebrations. And that brings us to the end of the show, Carrie.
It always goes too fast, Terry.
It's been a real pleasure, and we hope to see you really soon. And thank you very much for joining us tonight. And I'll wish you all a Merry Christmas well in advance. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Listening to Roadkill Radio.